Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's truly an honor to welcome each and every one of you tonight here to the Beis Menachem Chabad House, living the enduring legacy of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, another beautiful lecture brought to you by the Menachem Institute. Before we begin, it's important to point out that anything that has to do with infertility, thoughts, deeds, actions, of course, in a responsible and privileged manner, should be, of course, discussed with a competent halachic authority, because the issues are very sensitive and there is a way to conform them, hopefully, with halacha. They asked the question regarding a child who came home from school one day. It's an old story, and he's very frustrated, and he goes over to his mom and says, "Mom, where do I come from?" And the mother starts to blush, and she thinks this and that, and she starts to talk about embryos and about eggs, and she gets all flustered. She says, "When your father comes home, you'll ask him." Anyway, dad comes home, and he says, "Tati, where do I come from?" And he starts talking about birds and about bees. And the kid really gets frustrated, and he finally lets both parents have it in an emotional outpouring. He says, "I don't understand you. Today they went around the class and they asked kids where they came from. This one's from Cleveland, this one's from Toronto. Why can't you tell me where I come from?" There's another one that goes with that, but you have much better speakers here tonight. And maybe we'll talk about it in the sukkah. I want to thank Rabbi Green and Rabbi Yankee. I'll thank myself a little bit as well for putting forth tremendous effort tonight. You know, there's rarely been a title such as topics off limits, infertility, abortion, IVF. Sounds like a radar missile control, birth control, gender selection, surrogate mothers. There's rarely been such a provocative and controversial title, and a lot of effort was put forth to get three of the most outstanding, not only intellectuals for their profundity of wisdom, but very decent and good people who are very involved in the community and every fabric and every fiber of society. And the reality is that this lecture is based upon something that the Rebbe would always say to people in the name of his predecessor, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe. That even in the most intimate of Jewish circles, and he used the words, "Medav hobim esiras nefesh hobim kinder." We have to have a sacrificial commitment to have children. And therefore, tonight is a very beautiful evening, because the pain of infertility is obviously a very overwhelming one. It need not be discussed, the pain, the emptiness, the loneliness. It's immeasurable and indescribable. And may all of us be blessed with healthy and happy children. Let us all say amen. I think the question really is that in today's modern technology, where the frontiers of yesterday are being shattered, where we need to try to understand how there is no conflict at times between things which rarely are explicit, which generally are explicitly in conflict. Because we know that science is the accumulation of more and more empirical evidence. But what we prove today, tomorrow we may be wrapping fish in, because science is germane today and it's ever evolving and moving. Torah is the Shashuyei HaMelech. It's the infinite wisdom of the Creator, and therefore it's boundless and it transcends the limitations of here and now. And I think the bigger question is, how can you bring an infinite God into a finite world? And how can we amalgamate and try to bring a synthesis between the cutting edge of the medical world with the fostering of God's will in conformity with halacha? Now, it's very misunderstood in society. We have with us tonight three wonderful people who are technical, who are brilliant, and also have a sensitivity to understand, not only by Yom HaMahim, but Bisman Hazer. So the order of the evening tonight will be, and I will introduce our speakers first, and we'll do it quickly and punctually and in order so that, in general, the evening will flow. Because we believe all of this is the farshpais. This is really the smorgasbord for the Q&A that will take place in about 50 minutes from now. We have with us a scholar and a gentleman, a man who I've known for many years, Dr. Michael Feynman, who's probably won every award in the fertility or infertility world. He looks pretty fertile to me. Can I order? And let's not get personal. And Dr. Feynman is not only a specialist in OBGYN, but his specialty is reproductive endocrinology, and he's really been at the forefront of many of the mechanisms which enable people to go beyond what seems to be limitations. He's won every award in the book. I've seen him time and time again. He's connected to our Chabad of the Ganeo office. He's a very proud Jew, and he's a man who approaches life with great sensitivity, and we want to thank him for being here tonight. He is an expert not only in our community, but globally. He is an expert in his field, and he is an associate professor at UCLA School of Medicine. Let's give him a rousing round of applause. And the way the evening is going to work is Dr. Feynman will open up, then Rabbi Schusterman will respond to many of the salient points that Dr. Feynman offers. Then our next speaker after Rabbi Schusterman is the indomitable dear friend of mine. We go back a long way, our own Chabad of the Valley, a congregant of Chabad of Encino, a dear friend of Rabbi Gordon, a friend of all the Chabad rabbis. I think he has triplets of his own. Dr. Roy Manzano, who has gone to schools such as Technion. I'm a little biased because he went to Yale University, which is in the heart of Elm City, New Haven, Connecticut, where I was born and bred. And the Yale School of Medicine is way up there as well. And he's a specialist in OBGYN and also in the world of fetal monitoring. And he knows his stuff because I've sent people to him time and time again when they have high-risk pregnancies. Many of us in this room have probably spoken to him. And he's a man also who amalgamates and brings together Torah and science in a beautiful sense. He's a great expert, and we're truly lucky to have, let's give him a rousing round of applause, Dr. Roy Manzano. We always save the most favored for the last, as the Torah instructs us, Acharon, Acharon Chaviv. I must say on a personal level that I and all the Chabad rabbis who have a connection with this very special Jew are truly lucky. It's probably rarely a day that goes by that I don't have the merit to speak to him on a personal level, on a friendship level, on an instruction level. This is the rabbi's rabbi here in Southern California, but Rabbi Yosef Schusterman, let's welcome him warmly, is a global authority on Jewish law. He is the director of Chabad activities in all of Beverly Hills, the spiritual leader of Chabad of North Beverly Hills. By the way, there are many shilas which come up, questions, halacha queries. In this organization, certainly in the mikveh, he is the official halachic posek here in Southern California, but on a closer level here in Tarzana and Encino and to all of the Batei Chabad. Not only an amazing scholar, but he is known for his profundity of wisdom that is elucidated in a very clear way. Now, when I talk to you and you ask me a question and I try to give you an answer, you walk away scratching your heads and saying, whoa, what did he say? Did he answer my question? Rabbi Schusterman, as a rabbi's rabbi, is a very, very clear-speaking person. And let's welcome all of our speakers tonight. Bruchim Habayim. Once again, our first speaker will speak. Rabbi Schusterman will offer comments. Our next speaker will speak. Rabbi Schusterman will offer comments. It'll be a 2010-2010 type of situation. And then we will open it up for the provocative questions. Ladies and gentlemen, our first speaker, Dr. Michael Feynman.
Thank you, Rabbi. I'm better. I you made me feel so good. I want to go to me. Well, in reality, I'm not actually going to be speaking to you about IVF tonight. That's like the Trojan horse. Am I allowed to say Trojan horse? So it's a cover for what is really a bird's eye view of how Jewish law, our tradition, our texts, our rabbis are dynamically able to handle modern technology in this age to let Jewish people participate in the modern age, not exclude them from it. And to me, this is the most important message of the talk and why it's appropriate that all kinds of folks are here. Whether you're interested in infertility or not is not important. It's really, to me, the theme is we are an ancient people with ancient texts that can help deal with modern issues in a very constructive way. Now, I was a professor at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York, Yeshiva University. I worked with a Rabbi Tendler there, a very well-known man as well, on developing some halakhic insights, not only to IVF, but egg donation, which was truly pioneering at the time. And at that time, there was a big front page article and a centerpiece article following it on the church's ban on IVF. Now, that was big news in New York. I was laughing. It probably now be like, you know, page six of the, you know, sports section. But in New York, it was big news. They banned IVF. That's it. You cannot do IVF if you're a observant Catholic. But the response of the Jewish world was not that. In the beginning, I believe there was resistance. And I like to kid around that while our Catholic friends were saying, you know, that's a human being in the dish, the rabbis were saying, how do I know that's my human being in the dish? That was the issue. And so as we'll see, they addressed it. They didn't just shove it away. So very quickly, so we do have a technical and medical basis to understand what Rabbi Schusterman will help discuss, are the brief steps of the IVF process. First, there's screening, and I won't go into that, but basically, you know, we have to make sure that all the parts are working properly to be able to do the IVF cycle. I do want to focus on one part of it, which is not commonly seen as part of the screening, which is genetic screening. And again, the Jewish people have been at the forefront of this process, not by their desire, but because, of course, of our sad propensity to carry the Tay-Sachs gene. So Tay-Sachs screening has been part of the Jewish community for 50 years. We've pioneered genetic screening. We've made genetic screening kind of normal. And so now there are these fantastic panels of genes that people can do for a few $100. One of them has 100 genes on it, including now there's a Jewish panel. There's like 10 or more diseases that are part of the Ashkenazi panel. That's part of being the chosen people, I guess. And of course, as a rule, the Jewish people, the rabbis, do embrace this totally. The only little difference is, we can chat about it later, is in still parts of the Orthodox world, it's done in secret. So the young men and women don't actually know their results. There's an agency that tells them when they're going to go out with somebody whether or not they're quote compatible genetically. And in this day and age, when you can practically order the test on the internet, I have some questions about the appropriateness of that. Then once they begin the treatment, they take these potent so-called fertility drugs that cause the production of multiple eggs. They get monitored with ultrasound and blood tests. Eventually then, when the eggs are deemed ready by these criteria, there's a small procedure, which we actually did the first one in New York. It's an ultrasound-guided egg retrieval with light anesthesia using a needle to quickly aspirate the eggs out from the ovaries. Then using various techniques, there's fertilization of the eggs in the lab. Either they're fertilized naturally or there's a process called ICSI where individual sperm are actually placed into each egg. They're cultured in the lab now either to 3 days or 5 days. The 5-day embryo is called the blastocyst. And then the transfer of the embryos to the uterus is done gently through the cervix without anesthesia, just lightly depositing them in the uterus, usually with ultrasound guidance, and then Hashem takes over at that point. Unfortunately, not as often as we want. An important part of the IVF process has become cryopreservation or freezing of extra embryos. So a big push in the last several years has been to lower the multiple pregnancy rate by better selecting embryos for transfer and not putting so many embryos back. And I'll come back to that point a few times in my presentation. So that's what ICSI looks like. That's an egg. You can see on the right side there, there's a little tiny little glass tube. It actually contains a sperm, and it's being injected into an egg. And that's a blastocyst. So this is a miracle in front of you. It's a microcosm of the whole pregnancy. The outer cells that you see there become the placenta. They call it trophoblast. That's the embryo, the actual embryo. And then this tiny little drop of fluid that's in there, it's called a blastocyst because it has fluid, it becomes the gestational sac, the amniotic fluid. So what you're seeing there in a microscope is what grows a billion times to become the fetus, the placenta, the gestational sac. And it's in a tiny little dish in our lab. It's quite a miracle. And here we see the process called PGD, or pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. A small amount of the outer cells of that trophoblast are being sucked off the embryo by another tiny glass pipette under a microscope. And those cells can be sent for analysis, either for chromosomes, to find conditions like Down syndrome, and of course, germane to our group, genetic diseases like Tay-Sachs, if the couple is found to be carrying one of those genes. Again, a true miracle, raising the level of IVF from just having children, which is wonderful enough, to preventing tragedy and disease. Briefly, I just have the current, this is, they're a few years old because the SART, that's the Society of Assisted Reproductive Technology, numbers run a few years behind. I need to update this, but basically the numbers are our numbers reported to SART, and the numbers in parentheses are the national average. So our group, HRC Fertility, does fairly well compared to the rest of the world. You can see the reason I'm showing is not just so much to brag, but there's a lot of misconception, if you will, that IVF has really bad success rates. And while, you know, we would always like it to be higher, and of course people going through a lot of expense and trouble and emotions and rabbis to deal with all this stuff, we'd like everybody to get pregnant right away. The success rates aren't as grim as people make it out to be. Now, of course, the huge one, the donors, those donor eggs, does have remarkably high success rates, much higher than nature could possibly give. And again, that's due to the ideal mechanism of a young egg, a well-prepared uterus, and embryo selection. And of course, for women over 40, the results are rather, you know, guarded, and that's because of the high rate of chromosomal abnormalities in the eggs. The basic thing I want to show you here is this is when we can test the embryos for their chromosomes, and what you can see is that the pregnancy rates down at the bottom of the table become almost the same in the younger and older women if an embryo is transferred, thus showing that a lot of the we can level that playing field if we can find a normal embryo. So I'd like to briefly touch on the theme of the evening with, again, deferring also to Rabbi Schusterman. And of course it goes on and on and on. But these are some of the quick things that come up almost universally for observant couples considering IVF. There's the semen production, of course. As we know, there are prohibitions against wantonly producing semen for no reason. And there are different ways that rabbis do guide the men on how to do this within halakha. And there are different approaches. I won't go into the details, but every rabbi has a different approach. The bottom line is they do allow the men to do it. Of course, the status of the embryo, I jokingly spoke about it earlier. The Jewish religion doesn't consider a fertilized egg a full human being, but we don't consider it, you know, like a cat either. So it's kind of in between, and there's reverence for the embryo. We don't go out of our way to waste embryos. And so for me, Jewish patients is not a problem, because once they've gotten over the hang-up of this being a human being, whatever embryo is in the freezer, it's going to get used. You know, we don't have too many observant couples that say, I want one child. So it's really not a big issue once we get through that hurdle of, is it a full human life? The concept of kosher IVF, I also spoke a little bit about that. That's my kind of coined term. The way that the rabbis dealt with the question of is that my embryo was by creating an amazingly sophisticated system of supervision of the IVF lab. As you all know, what makes it being kosher is not just it being kosher, it's the supervision that goes into making it kosher. And so what makes IVF kosher, partly, is this amazing system of supervision. One of the pioneers of this is a Chabad rabbi from Sydney, Australia. And I meet with him periodically. I talk to him, and he has a whole protocol of how to do this. And I work with the PUA Institute here in Los Angeles, who train women to come to our IVF lab. They're sitting, the nice women with shavels and white coats on, sitting in my IVF lab, watching every step of the process to make sure there are no mistakes made in the lab that would potentially affect the lineage of the family. Now, we're proud to say we don't think there are many errors in the IVF lab. Of course, there should be zero errors. But until there's someone supervising it, it ain't kosher. Third-party parenting, that refers to egg donors or surrogates. This obviously is still what you would call on the frontier of halakha, even though it's been around for over 20 years. The big question isn't whether it's allowed with egg donation, because egg donation is generally allowed by most Orthodox rabbis, and it's because the prescription to be fruitful and multiply falls on the man, and so egg donation allows the man to fulfill his obligation to be fruitful and multiply. Of course, the fact that the woman's dying to have a baby and wants to give birth to a baby, that's all well and good too. But the thing that helped the rabbis through this was that first commandment. Surrogacy is a little trickier. When I've spoken to other Chabad rabbis about this, they were not comfortable with surrogacy, so it's not yet universally embraced by the Orthodox world. Of course, the questions that come up that are still being argued over are, you know, what makes the baby Jewish? This is a kind of fascinating part of halakha that could take up a whole evening, you know. And when I started at Albert Einstein with Rabbi Tendler, it was very clear at that time that an egg donor did not need to be Jewish. In fact, there was a preference for non-Jewish egg donors. And about 5 or 6 years ago, some of our Haredi friends in Israel completely reversed that standing and all of a sudden said it should be a Jewish egg. And so that threw the world into turmoil, because there were many Orthodox couples who had already gone through egg donation with their non-Jewish donor. Just for the record, I happen to agree that it should be a non-Jewish donor. Judaism is not a genetic disease. Finally, the question of multiple pregnancies is a big one, because I think it's very important for us not to put religious people of either group, Christian or Jews, into a situation where they have a multiple pregnancy that they cannot do anything about. There is a process called selective reduction, which is a polite name for a type of abortion, where the late first trimester embryo can be extinguished in a high order multiple pregnancy, thus usually leaving the woman with twins. Obviously, it sounds gross. It's emotionally trying to go through. And for most Orthodox couples, it's a no-starter. And of course, for Christians, not even a discussion point. So it's very important, I think, when we're talking about what type of treatment should be offered, to keep the person's religious and ethical and philosophical approaches or feelings in mind. So, for instance, there's a process called IUI, or intrauterine insemination, where the women frequently take fertility drugs and are just simply inseminated with their husband's sperm. And that process is actually more prone to multiple pregnancies, because we have no control over how many eggs are made or ovulated. Whereas with IVF and improved embryo selection and PGD, looking at the chromosomes, we can really get down to putting in single embryos now with good success rates and a totally reduced, almost zero, multiple pregnancy rate. And I think that's important when we're advising couples. And I would say to my rabbinical friends, that's an important thing to consider when advising whether couples should do IVF or not. All right, so did I come into the 20-minute mark? Okay. Thank you for your attention. We look forward to hearing from you. Happy to answer questions from the podium, and be happy to stay after if any private questions you have.
thank you, Rabbi Doctor. There's a lot of issues. I just want to say a general idea over here that I think is very important to keep in mind. Anytime any person is doing infertility treatment, you must have the guidance of a competent rabbi that knows both the halacha and the medical aspects of it. There are a lot of questions. It was mentioned before, you need to have self-sacrifice to have children. There's nothing more important in life than children. But it has to be done in a way which is halachically correct. In today's world, many, many rabbis permit a lot of these things, but they still need to be under rabbinic guidance. For instance, just to mention what Dr. Feynman was talking about, there are the questions how to produce the sperm, let's say for IVF or artificial insemination. And there are also questions, for instance, if you have donor sperm. So it's discussed in halacha. I'm just want to bring out issues that people need to keep in mind, why it's so important to have a competent rabbi with you on board in dealing with these issues. For instance, if somebody else's sperm is put into a woman, a married woman with another man's sperm, is that considered adultery in halacha? Would the child be considered a mamzer? Now, 99% of the rabbinic opinions maintain it's not a mamzer, because it wasn't done through actual sexual intercourse, it wasn't done through intimacy. But there is a question about it in halacha, and it needs to be discussed with the rabbi how to do it. Mentioned before how to get the donor sperm. Just to produce sperm is questionable in halacha. Many rabbis permit it. Some rabbis say it should be done by taking a condom with a hole in it, and a condom that doesn't have any spermicide in it, a natural condom, and that has a hole in it, that some of the sperm does go into the wife, and the rest of the sperm you take in this condom and bring it to the doctor. Some doctors like it, some doctors don't like it, some rabbanim like it, some rabbanim don't like it. But these are all, it's important to understand, we need to work together, the rabbis and the doctors together. Concerning the topic that the Dr. Feynman said about lineage, for instance, if you have a donor egg placed inside a woman. Now, I'm not saying it's not allowed, I'm not saying it can't be done, it could be done, but it has to be done with the rabbi, because the question over here is, who is the legal mother of the child? Is the donor egg considered the mother of the child, or is the woman that carries the baby considered the mother of the child? And then you have the question, same thing with surrogate, and this is what Dr. Feynman is alluding to. The question, if you have a surrogate mother, that the sperm and the egg of a different woman, and the sperm, let's say, of the husband is put into a different woman, and the other woman is carrying the baby for 9 months, so the question is, who is halachically the mother of the child? Is it the donor, or is it the surrogate? And then you go into the question, if the donor is not Jewish and the surrogate mother is, or vice versa, the surrogate mother is not Jewish and the donor egg is Jewish, so then the question is the child Jewish or not? And you have various opinions, and it's still argued, and still being discussed in contemporary halacha. Another interesting question for religious people is, can you put back the sperm and the egg back into the mother during the time she's a nida, when she's impure menstrual before going to the mikveh? Is it allowed to be done even though she wasn't able to go to the mikveh yet? That's another issue. Again, all these things are dealt with in halacha, and they could be dealt with, but they need to be discussed with a competent rabbi. Also, even about when they have the genetic testing, the question is, what happens if, God forbid, you find out that the child is Down syndrome, or the child is Tay-Sachs, or the child, God forbid, has a life-endangering situation? So the question then goes, are you allowed to do an abortion on the fetus or not? And this is an extremely complicated halachic issue that must be decided with, because very few rabbis, by the way, want to deal with this question of abortion, because it is a question of taking a life. There are those that permit it, there are those that don't permit it. But these are issues, because just because the child is sick does not mean it's not a viable human being. It's still a human being. And the question is, are you allowed to do it, and what stage of the pregnancy is it allowed to be done? Then you have what Dr. Feynman also mentioned, what happens if you have multiple embryos inside, and then some of them are at risk and some of them are not at risk, and which ones do you save? Let's say there's five things going around there, and you don't know, you can't save all five, let's say. So now the question is, which one are we going to decide to save versus let the other ones just die? And this is a very complicated halacha, but it is discussed in contemporary halacha. It is discussed, there are rulings about it, but these are all issues why it's so important to have the rabbis together dealing with this issue together with the doctors. And of course, as the issue of Shemitah, to make sure that there is a proper supervision to make sure that the sperm is the sperm of the one that gave it, and the eggs are the eggs of the ones that gave it, and not switching it or doing booster sperm to take it from somebody else to give a booster sperm. All these things need reliable, proper supervision. I just want to conclude with the second half of Rabbi Morty's story, that there was this kid that came home and said to the father, where do we come from? So the father starts saying, well, you know, we come from the monkeys and the apes and this and that. It goes on and on, the whole evolution story. The mother comes home later. The kid says, Ma, where do we come from? So the mother says, you know, there was Adam and Eve, and there was this and Noah and the whole. So the kid says to the mother, I don't understand. Dad says we come from the monkeys, and you tell we come from people. So the mother says, it's very simple. He's talking about his side of the family. I'm talking about my side of the family.
I just want to remind everybody that we're going to have questions and answers at the end. If anybody would like to ask questions anonymously, there is a box, and you can write down the question and have it handed up. Or you can ask questions by yourself, whatever will be more comfortable.
I got it.
I want to thank Rabbi Green for asking me to speak here tonight. At first, I really was not sure what to talk about. And Rabbi Green really simplified it for me. He said, talk about what you do and let Rabbi Schusterman tell you whether halachically it's okay to do or not. So let me start off that way. So what I am is, I'm a maternal fetal medicine specialist. And what that basically means is, in short, my job is to, once you are pregnant, help a woman carry a healthy pregnancy. So that comes into really three separate categories. First is to care for mothers with chronic health problems and to keep them healthy during the pregnancy, so their body is healthy and their chronic health problem does not affect the growing fetus. Second is to care for mothers who are experiencing complications with their pregnancy. What types of complications? What we talked about, multiples, early labor, bleeding, high blood pressures. And then lastly is to care for the fetus that's basically facing the non-routine, like birth defects and growth problems. And so let's kind of go through this one by one. So first, caring for the mother's chronic health problems. Why is this important? Because until really recently, many women were told not to get pregnant. Women with heart disease, women with type 1 diabetes, rheumatic diseases such as lupus and epilepsy, as well as many other diseases. Why? For many reasons. Whether their medications were contraindicated during the pregnancy, whether the belief was that the pregnancy would adversely affect their pre-existing medical problems to the point where they would really deteriorate. And so that's really no longer the case. I can really, on one hand, count the number of diseases that are currently we recommend women not to get pregnant, but otherwise it's there are really very few limitations. This is a picture that I don't see too much in my office. This is a young, healthy, pregnant woman. Why is that? And that's because the demographics are changing. We're now part of the rat race, and couples are deciding to wait and hold off on having children. People are going after their careers. Everybody wants to make their first $10 million before they have their first kid. And so the demographics are changing, and we see that here. We see that the average age of the mother at the first conception is between 30 to 34. That's really changed a lot in the past 20 to 30 years. And so my patients really are not looking like this anymore, but this is more the common woman that's walking into my office, significantly older, and with age come other issues, likewise. What we see here in this table, a table of chronic medical problems. And these chronic medical problems we see increase with age. Why is this important? Because in our 20s, really the chronic medical problems such as heart disease, diabetes, obesity, etc., are minimal. And so we were not worried about it. 20-year-old women having kids, who cares? But now as women are moving into their 30s, 40s, and 50s, these problems are becoming a lot more significant, and we have to manage these issues as the pregnancies advance. My second job is to manage pregnancy complications. So what kind of complications are common? Well, first are prematurity, preterm labor. This is a major issue because if a woman goes into preterm labor and delivers a preterm baby, then that baby is at risk for many chronic illnesses, acute illnesses, death, etc. And what's interesting here is that this timeline and the rates of prematurity are increasing. So that doesn't make sense. Medicine is advancing, prematurity is increasing. We're not really sure how healthy looking child. Along with pregnancy complications come high blood pressure. And this is a phenomenon known as preeclampsia. So preeclampsia is ultimately the blood pressure increases with pregnancy. And along with that come other issues, effects on the liver, effects on the brain, effects on the kidneys. And with severe preeclampsia, it can lead all the way to maternal seizures and sometimes stroke. Now this is quite scary. The good news is that you see that any preeclampsia line, the top line, has really not changed in frequency in the past 30 years. We still haven't figured out what causes preeclampsia or how to stop preeclampsia, but we know how to treat the women with a preeclampsia. The concern is the bottom line, the severe preeclampsia, which in many women includes seizures and sometimes stroke. And the concern is that line is increasing in frequency. And a lot of the contributions there are advanced maternal age and multiple gestations. So let me tell you about multiple gestations. I know about multiple gestations. So these are my kids, and my wife and I were blessed to have triplets. And you see here, the top graph is the incidence of twin births, the bottom of incidence of triplet births, and they're climbing. And just as Dr. Feynman commented, a lot of this is due to fertility treatment. When a woman walks into my office with multiples, I explain to them they basically have four risks. Risk number one is premature labor. The average singleton delivers at 40 weeks. The average twins delivers at 36 weeks. The average triplets delivers at 32 weeks, and so on and so forth. Second risk is preeclampsia. I just spoke about that. Third risk is gestational diabetes. and Lazarus are babies that will not grow to their full potential or growth restricted. You have to remember, the human uterus was intended for one. The more babies that that are in the uterus, the complications increase. And we get pictures like this, higher order multiples. Quintuplets. On the right is octomom. She's missing two babies there, but this is a major issue, and this is where the topic of selective fetal reduction comes up, where the attempt is to decrease the number of fetuses in order to decrease complications. Now, again, this is not my topic. This is more Rabbi Schusterman's topic. Lastly, care for the unborn baby. So this is Dr. Pinard. Dr. Pinard came up with the Pinard horn, which you see the woman on the right evaluating the fetus with. This is how I was trained. No, I'm just kidding. This is how they still do it in third world countries, obviously. Things have changed slightly, and this is more like what we're doing now. We're able to evaluate the fetuses with a lot of detail using ultrasound. These are all beautiful images of nice, healthy babies. But it's not only about getting you a cute picture of your baby's face. The importance is evaluating the health of the babies. And let me go into a few cases for you. So here we're starting with an ultrasound of a fetus where we're evaluating the heart. On the left side of the heart, we see a vessel coming off. This is called the pulmonary artery. The problem is the pulmonary artery is supposed to come from the right side of the heart. So this is called transposition of the great vessels. This is a major problem. If a baby was to be born with this and this not recognized, the baby could very well die. The benefit of identifying this in utero is because once this is identified, the patient is sent to the liver at a center where pediatric cardiac surgery is done. And following such surgery, you have a nice, healthy baby with just a scar on the chest. Second case here is what we call aortic coarctation. So the aortic coarctation, the aorta is the main blood vessel that exits the heart. It takes oxygen to the rest of our body. And you see the arrows here, the aorta is pinched. Instead of being this open vessel, it's reduced to a very narrow lumen. The problem here is that a baby born with this initially presents as quite healthy. And in the hospital, this would not be recognized immediately due to changes in between the fetal physiology and the newborn physiology. And many times, parents will take a baby like this home, and unfortunately, after a few days, a baby like this will turn blue and many times die. When this is identified in utero, we have the ability, again, to send the patient to the appropriate facility. The baby undergoes surgery. You see the correction here. And the baby can live a healthy life. We even have more cosmetic diagnoses. This is a cleft lip. We see the cleft lip identified here on ultrasound. Baby born with a cleft lip and then surgically corrected. And so the question becomes, well, why is this important to identify in utero? Who cares? So the baby has a cleft lip. This can be identified later on and taken care of later on. But ultimately, I think that it, number one, when we identify this in utero, we send the mother to speak, number one, with a maxillofacial surgeon. So the surgeon can prepare the mother for what's to come, the type of surgery that the baby will need. And we also send the mother, to speak with a lactation consultant. Because given the cleft lip, the baby is unable to suck and form suction. And so breastfeeding becomes difficult, and special bottles are needed in order to help feed the baby. And so this gives the mother a lot of preparation so that not all of this hits her at the time of delivery. This is an ultrasound image of the spine. We see here a 2D and a 3D image. This is in the middle of the back, and we see a hole here in the middle of the back. And we see that same defect here. This is called spina bifida. Spina bifida is a very serious congenital abnormality. and many times results in basically paralysis from the point of the defect down. Now, with modern medicine, we have an amazing ability to do surgery in utero for these babies. And this, and we're now able to close these defects in utero at several centers in the United States, and this helps reduce some of the long-term disabilities that these babies or these children and individuals have. So this is where my talk gets more religious, biblical, if you will. Can anybody tell me who these two are? Anyone? Yeah, very nice. Yaakov and Esav, right? So why am I talking about Yaakov and Esav? Well, I actually have their birth picture here. This was emailed to me. So on the right we have Esav, on the left we have Yaakov, right? One born red and hairy, the other one born really pale. So why am I bringing this up? Because historians have looked at this, and many biblical scholars, and have come to understand that this is actually a phenomenon, and most likely the first phenomenon of what's called twin-twin transfusion syndrome. What twin-twin transfusion syndrome is when you have identical twins that share a placenta. And what occurs, here we go, what occurs is that the circulation between the two twins is connected, and ultimately one steals from the other. And so here you have a big baby because it's getting all of the nutrients, and you have a small baby not getting the nutrients. And you say, okay, fine, so one's a little bigger, one's a little smaller, who cares? But this could be quite severe and can even result in death of one of the fetuses. Why is this important to identify? Well, this is important to identify because we have a way to treat it now. Using laser technology, we're able to insert a laser into the uterus and cut off the connection between the two. By cutting off this connection, you're not the recipient, or the one that's, if you will, stealing the nutrients, is able to we're able to stop that process and giving the donor a chance. This is an ultrasound. It's a little bit difficult to see here, but we see a lot of fluid in this baby's abdomen, a lot of fluid under the skin. This is what's called fetal hydrops, and it's a sign of fetal anemia. Why does fetal anemia occur? For many reasons. Whether it's a viral infection, whether it's maternal antibodies that are attacking the baby's blood and resulting in the baby becoming anemic. And so why is this important to identify in utero? The reason this is important is because we're now able to transfuse the baby blood in utero. So if a baby is anemic, we have the technology to now transfuse the baby with the necessary blood and actually save the baby in this situation. But it's not always invasive. Technology is not moving towards invasive. We're actually trying to move away from invasive, and we see that here. There is a medical situation in which the mother has a certain blood type, the baby has another blood type, and the mother actually makes antibodies against her baby's type, her baby's blood type, and that significantly increases the woman's risk that her baby will be anemic, such as the image we previously saw. Up until about 10, 15 years ago, the only way to assess whether the baby was anemic or not is by basically doing a fetal blood test, getting a fetal blood sample. So it was approximately a weekly assessment. A needle used to be placed into the umbilical cord, getting fetal blood and making a determination as to whether the baby is anemic and whether the baby needed to be transfused. We now have the ability to check that by ultrasound. By looking at the circulation to the baby's brain, we're able to determine as to whether the baby is anemic and whether the baby needs any sort of treatment. These cases are a little bit more difficult, and we'll really outline the importance of some of this imaging. So this is a case of what's called a molar pregnancy. A molar pregnancy is when the placenta is abnormal and really invasive. The placenta acts more like a cancer. And by acting like a cancer, at that point, number one, there's no fetus. And number two, the mother's life becomes at risk, because if this is not treated, the cancer, the placenta can metastasize to various parts in the maternal body and ultimately kill the mother. So it's really critical to identify this in utero. In this case, they identified a little bit too late, and what that required is a hysterectomy. And you see here the size of the woman's uterus. The entire uterus had to be removed. But if this is identified early enough, at around weeks, actually I would say about by weeks 14, then at that point only the uterine contents can be removed, and the woman can keep her fertility and life. I told you these are more difficult images, so bear with me. This is an early assessment of a fetus, and we see that the top of the head is missing. This is called acrania, where the brain and the top of the skull is missing. This is a severe congenital anomaly, not consistent with life, and in this case, this is one of the cases that we do recommend termination of the pregnancy. And again, this is an area where you would have to consult your rabbi. This is a case of trisomy 13. Trisomy 13 is a severe chromosomal abnormality. We have it comes with several structural abnormalities. One of them is a single eye or a cyclops. This is also a chromosomal abnormality that's not consistent with life. If anything, the babies will maybe live 1 or 2 days and then demise. And due to maternal health, we do recommend termination for these cases as well. And lastly, this is a case where we see that the fetal bowel is outside of the baby's abdomen. This becomes tricky, and this shows, I chose this case because this is to show that not all of the decisions we make are very black and white. The reason this is difficult is because while this may be associated with what's called trisomy 18, which again is a very significant chromosomal abnormality that is consistent with only a very short lifespan, maybe up to a month. I think the most they've documented is a year. This can also be seen in normal baby. And so the question becomes, okay, so you identify a structural abnormality. The next question is, genetically, is the baby normal? And the way you make that determination is via two ways. One could be in an early fashion, what's called a CVS, where a straw is inserted into the placenta, and a small piece of placenta is acquired in order to test the genetics. And the second is later in the pregnancy, called an amniocentesis, where a needle is placed into the fluid where the baby's swimming. A small amount of fluid is aspirated, and that fluid has the baby's cells in it, and therefore the baby's genetic makeup can be determined. But as I said, we're moving away from invasive testing, and in the last few years, we've been able to identify the baby's genetics via a blood test on the mother. Via a blood test on the mother, we're now able to find fetal DNA floating in maternal blood, and are now able to test for the baby's genes, and without an invasive test. The reason to avoid an invasive test is because invasive testing does come with risk for pregnancy loss. Now, I did not want to end with a grim note. I didn't want to bum everybody out. Everybody, oh God! But you need to know, statistically speaking, the odds are in your favor, or in the favor of any pregnant woman. The odds of any structural or chromosomal abnormality is extremely small, at about 3 to 5%, maybe slightly higher in certain cases. And despite any obstacles, we really encourage all women that desire to become pregnant to get pregnant. I'll finish off with a story that is about 5 years old. A woman walked into our office that's 59 years old. This woman had one daughter, and her daughter died in a car accident at the age of 30. The woman felt quite alone. She was very distraught. She's 59 years old, overweight, diabetic, high blood pressure. She saw a reproductive endocrinologist, such as Dr. Feynman, and he said to her, well, look, you know, I could potentially get you pregnant, but the question becomes, what happens when you are pregnant? So he sent her to see us to see if we can, you know, really create a plan for her. So sat her down and I told her, look, you need to lose weight, you need to start exercising, and let's see what happens. And in my mind, I think, you know, I see like the scene from Rocky, you know, where he's with the music in the background, and he's like running down the street, because I think that's what she did for 6 months. She lost weight, she cleared her diabetes and her high blood pressure, and came back and said, okay, I'm ready to get pregnant now. And we said, okay, fine. She went and got pregnant and delivered at 35 weeks gestation, a beautiful little girl. And if she can do it, then I think anybody can do it. Thank you very much.
There's not too much to comment, except we see the unbelievable miracle of pregnancy and the greatness of God in all of these things and the wisdom of modern technology and modern medicine that God bestows upon the doctors and the information to be able to have children and healthy children and to be productive and continue the human race. I just want to mention a few things. I mean, again, everything he said was not a question in halacha. Obviously, all these surgeries in vitro are allowed to be done. That's not a question with that. The only halachic issue that basically comes to mind is that if, God forbid, a fetus is posing a risk to the mother, that's the only time in halacha when an abortion is allowed. Abortion is allowed even though the human fetus is a human being. The question is, does it begin at conception 40 days or a little bit later? But there's no question that the fetus is considered a human being. And the question is, if the fetus is posing a risk to the life of the mother, so then halachically you do get rid of the fetus, you do abort it. And the reason for that is in halacha, because it's called with a rodef. The din of a rodef, if I see A running to kill B, and the only way I can stop A from killing B is by killing A, then the Torah says you're allowed to kill A, that A shouldn't be killing B. So therefore, the fetus is considered the one that's killing the mother, and therefore the halacha says you kill the murderer before they murder the mother. So therefore, the fetus, halachically, would be allowed to be killed. The question, which is a complicated halacha question, comes up. Once the baby is born, and now the doctors have a choice to make to save the mother's life or to save the baby's life, that becomes extremely complicated halachic issue. Who has precedence? Does the baby or does the mother? And that goes into many, many difficult details that cannot be discussed. You know, it has to be discussed with their rav. Even with fetal reduction, it is halachic question how to do it, which fetuses should be reduced. And again, like we mentioned before, the ones that have the best chance of survival are to be the ones that are kept. Otherwise, if they all have equal chances of survival, halacha needs to be asked who should be saved first. Man, boy, girl, girl, boy. I mean, the whole question comes up in halacha, which fetus should be saved, but that's only if they're all equally viable and equally chance of survival. In fact, I just to mention, somebody asked me the other day a very interesting halacha question. In fact, it was a shatchan, a matchmaker, and they asked me, if somebody was born in vitro, do you have an obligation to say for the shidduch that this person was born in vitro or not? If a child was conceived through in vitro fertilization, the child grows up, is getting ready to get married, must you disclose to the other parties involved that this child is born in vitro or not. And I discussed it with a very, very prominent rabbi that does in vitro, and I mean he supervises in vitro, and he was of the opinion adamantly that you don't have to say anything. It's nobody's business. If it was done in a kosher way, the kid's a kosher child, there's no need to say anything. I don't know if everybody would agree with that, but rabbis never agree anyway. So, but his opinion was there's absolutely no reason, if it was done properly in a kosher way, that there's no reason why you have to tell anybody about it. I think that covers all the issues that of the halachic aspect of the discussion. Now we can take. Okay, I was asked to discuss birth control and abortion because it was on the flyer. So I guess it's a biblical obligation to discuss what's on the flyer. Abortion, we said clearly, the only time an abortion is allowed if the mother's life is in danger. If, God forbid, a woman was raped and became pregnant, I mean, it is a very complicated halacha question. You need to find a competent rabbi to ask the question, are you allowed to do an abortion? Because if you look at it from a religious perspective, you know, the fact is God made her pregnant, and that means there is a viable baby, and, you know, do we have a right to kill that baby just because the woman, God forbid, was raped? And that's a separate issue by itself, but it needs to be discussed with a competent rabbi to see what the halacha is. Are you allowed to, or are you not allowed? As far as the actual issue of birth control, there are halachic guidelines of birth control. When a person is allowed to use birth control, and what method of birth control. But according to halacha, if a couple wants to use birth control, they need to speak, halachically I'm saying, they need to speak to a competent rabbi to find out, does the Torah allow them to use birth control or not? And even if they are allowed to use birth control, there are certain methods which are not allowed according to Torah law, such as a condom is not allowed, because basically what you're doing is you're just wasting the seed. You're causing the seed that the husband produced is going to waste, and it's a sin of wasting seed, which in the time of Talmudical times, biblical times, it was punished by death from heaven. Like we find in the Chumash with Yehuda's two sons, Aaron and Onan, for those that learn Parshas Vayeshev. But for instance, in most cases, after a woman has a baby and she wants to take a break, most rabbis will allow up to 2 years to take a break. Sometimes if there's a medical condition, they can get a heter or whatever, an allowance to use birth control for longer. But it needs to be discussed with the rabbi to know what method of birth control is allowed. Generally speaking, anything the woman uses is allowed. Anything the man's going to use is not allowed. But even in those cases, a competent rabbi should be discussed with to know what they're allowed to do and when they're allowed to do and in what circumstances they're allowed to do it. Okay, now we talked about it?
That was good.
Okay.
Let's do, if you want to, you guys have a microphone over here.
You wanted the first comment, yes?
Second.
Yeah. Before we go to the questions, Dr. Feynman has a comment.
Just a few thoughts that occurred. First of all, to some of you may be obvious, but there's a concept in Jewish law that just because it's permitted doesn't mean it's allowed. So this is where the flexibility and the nuances that Rabbi Schuster is talking about. Birth control, for instance, is permitted, and you have to find out if it's allowed. The same thing with much of IVF. In a sense, it's allowed, but it's with the wording of, as you said, the competent rabbi. You know, is it right for you, and how do you go about it for you? It's always individualized. It's one of the most touchy things about it. Two people can walk with the same problem and come out with two different answers.
Read this.
Also, you mentioned in the talk about genetic screening. I want to reemphasize that the traditional, the 1990s genetic screening was only available on the baby. So you know, there were a few diseases that could be detected, like Tay-Sachs. And cystic fibrosis of the fetus, and then the implication is that the choice is termination of the fetus, which by Jewish law is very difficult. because of the rules that we tend to go by to protect the mother's health, which because of fellows like him, there's almost no, I can't even think of anything really, really, except maybe, you know, end-stage heart disease, where the fetus is really threatening the mother anymore. It's not really, it's not a reality. The multiple pregnancy risk, and the reason the rabbis have trouble with this, and don't just make a knee-jerk yes, is it really, it's not being done for the mother's sake, it's being done for the fetus' sake. So you got four equal babies in there, how do you decide, you know, to terminate one for the other? So that's why it's not so simple. But I just want to bring out again that through this magic of PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, we can screen couples ahead of time, preconception, which most Jewish couples are doing, for this whole host of diseases, Tay-Sachs, Gaucher's disease, all this, sickle cell, in African American, and so forth. And if that couple is both carrying the gene, we can, through in vitro fertilization, find the embryos that would have the disease and not transfer them and prevent the tragedy from having advanced. Clearly a halakhically superior approach. So there comes in the other question, that if it's permitted, it's allowed. So the anonymous genetic screening, part of that is to prevent the need for it. So the rabbis would still argue, yeah, keep it anonymous, don't let the two people date. Because while it's permitted, it's preferred not to do it. So if a couple could get married and not have to go through this aggravation, it'd be much better. So that's again kind of that nuanced world group we share, where we do have the technology to help a couple not have a Tay-Sachs baby, but from a biblical point of view, it's probably better not to even get into that boat.
Okay, we're going to take questions now. Go ahead, Esty.
Okay, first of all, thank you, Nancy, for arranging and all of the panel. Thank you so much. This is so interesting and so helpful. My question is, if there's so much that you can do while the woman is pregnant, why do some of the customers not do ultrasound?
Okay, I'm going to repeat the question just so that it gets recorded, okay? Her question was, from what we've seen tonight, there's so much that can be done to help a woman if there are difficulties in the pregnancy. Why is there some sort of a custom not to do ultrasound? I guess you want to address that to Rabbi Schusterman first?
Yes, I'll stop. There was a time that Rebbe was against just routine ultrasound because they didn't know the long-term effect of the radiation, I don't know if I'm using the right word, but of the ultrasound in the body. As time went on, most even Chabad rabbis will encourage the 20-week ultrasound, which is the one that's able to detect things and correct them. So many rabbis would encourage that. But again, any time the doctor feels there's a medical need to do an ultrasound, high-risk pregnancy, or women had miscarriages before. Anytime there's a high-risk pregnancy, they do allow, it's not forbidden, but if it just was said, well, we don't know the long-term outcomes of that, which now there is an outcome known of it. Now the question is, the Yiddish question is, now that we're going to do an ultrasound, can we figure out the sex of the baby, and can we know it, and can we find out about it? That's a dull Yiddish question. It's not a halachic issue. If you want to find out the gender of the baby, there's nothing wrong with it. But a lot of, you know, old-fashioned Jews want the surprise of it. By the way, there was somebody in my shul many years ago that did a test, you know, the gender test, and they told them they're having a girl, and they painted the room pink, and they got it, and they washed it and everything. And they had a boy. And I was at the bris.
That was not our office. I'd like to comment, by the way, regarding the long-term effects of ultrasound, because this is a very important question. So a lot of recent studies looking at ultrasound. First, you need to understand how ultrasound works. Ultrasound basically works the same way as the police officer that's looking for you with a radar gun. The radar gun sends off a very high-frequency sound signal. It bounces off an object, it bounces back, and the ultrasound then reads the speed by which it bounces back, and by that generates an image.
how do the sound signals get transmitted or sent out initially inside the ultrasound probe, the stick that we hold while we do the ultrasound. So it's a crystal that vibrates very, very quickly. So studies have been done looking at whether this vibration causes any issues for the fetus. And they've actually shown that there are potentially adverse effects. The adverse effects occur when the crystal is vibrating at a very, very fast rate, and that fast rate can have the potential of actually heating up or warming up the amniotic fluid. If the amniotic fluid is heated up to too high, then it can affect the way that in which the brain is developing. It's called neuronal migration. The reason that this is, so studies have been done, these studies have initially been done in rats. Ultimately, what they did in these rats is they took a pregnant rat, they tied an ultrasound probe to the pregnant rat's abdomen and turned the machine on and saw how much time it really required to get an abnormality in this neuronal migration. And what they found was that for a rat, it took a day, about 24 hours, to ultimately end with this abnormality. What's important to note is, number one, the maternal rat, or the rat pregnancy, the gestation, is a total of between 20 to 21 days. And so it's about 1/20th of the total pregnancy. And the other point is that not at every ultrasound setting did they note this issue, which means that the higher frequencies are only performed when we perform the Doppler, when we look at circulation of blood, like you've seen in some of these images. And the idea is that with an experienced ultrasound office, and this is all regulated by the American Institute of Ultrasound Medicine, they should know not to turn the Dopplers on for prolonged periods of time. You're looking at the heart, you turn it off, you get the image you need, you turn it on, you get the image you need, you turn it off. And so it's very, very short portions of time, and in these shortened portions of time, no issues for the fetus have been reported.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, the first speaker had talked about many things that were, I forgot, now I'm confused if you said allowed or permitted. Many things that were allowed but may not be permitted.
He said permitted but not allowed.
And then when Rabbi Schisterman addressed several of the things that you discussed, you added to each of them that you need to speak to a rabbi, you need to speak to a rabbi, so then it became less clear as to whether or not many of the things that you do or that you say you do would be permitted for everybody. And my question is, you know, we know we're supposed to pick a rabbi and stick with the rabbi, not supposed to have different opinions, but the feeling that I got was that so many of these issues, if you ask the wrong rabbi, you will not be allowed to proceed in one way. If you ask the right rabbi, you will be allowed to proceed. And I didn't really get a sense where someone who might have an issue would come.
I'm just going to repeat the question in one sentence. There are times when Rabbi Schisterman keeps saying, ask the rabbi. The fear is you ask the rabbi and you get the answer of no, or for that matter, how do you know who the right rabbi is? As Rabbi Schisterman himself said, there are some rabbis who allow it.
Generally speaking, I can't speak for all rabbis. Rabbis are very sensitive to the issues. Personally, I can tell you a lot of times people call me with halachic questions that I personally feel, not about this issue, just general halachic issues that I feel, I don't know of a leniency for it. But I tell them, you know what, feel free to ask somebody else. Because I cannot permit it, but there are rabbis that permit it, and feel free. And sometimes I will tell people who to call, because I know that they do permit certain things. So when you're calling a rabbi, let's say, about all these infertility issues, and you say, listen, and don't use the word nothing personal, but like I'm looking for a way to be able to do it. If you're not able to give me a leniency in this, can you guide me to the one that would? And they would deal, you know, if it's a competent rabbi that allows you to do it, nobody's going to say that something's wrong, even though they personally can't give that leniency. So these issues, it's very important to tell the rabbi to beforehand that, you know, I really would like to do it, and if you don't feel you can give me leniency, can you guide me to a rabbi that will? And they will.
I'm sorry, is there ever times when a certain situation, there's just no way that there's a rabbi who's going to say yes?
Yeah. Abortion for the fun of it. Is no rabbi who's going to say yes?
The good news is that, first, there's two things. First of all, as I started my talk, most of this is allowed. So at least from the infertility point of view, you don't have to really worry. The only area there's still somewhat of an argument about surrogacy, and that's a really, really small number of our patients who really need a surrogate mother. So it's still an issue, and that's the one kind of touchy area. The other thing is there are rabbis like Rabbi Schusterman, there's Rabbi Ullman, and he's the fellow, and the wonderful fellow in Sydney I mentioned. These are pioneers in reproductive medicine who are known to help couples. They're there to help you. They're not there to block you. So obviously, if you go to somebody that's way out there you don't know, you may get that. But with these types of rabbis who, in a sense, specialize in reproductive medicine, they're there to help you do and not to block you. They're there to help you make a kosher IVF, not to block you, but to help you. So at least from our perspective, it's not really a problem. I mean, I have Chabad and other Orthodox patients, and they're doing it. You know, they're just doing it. Each one has a little shtick this way, that way, you know, and we accommodate it. It's nothing. It's not big stuff. It's, you know, this Rabbi Ullman, for instance, wants the couple have their own special bottle of culture meat, and we got to open it the day of the procedure. That's their bottle of culture meat. It's $50, you know. So that's fine. So little. That's what I mean by a shtick. Some rabbis say yes, and so that's why, at least in our field, you don't have to worry about it. Now, in some of the touchier areas of halakha, obviously, which we're not talking about tonight so much, you know, yes, you could get caught, I guess, in a situation where the rabbi's not helping you, but if there are people of integrity like Rabbi Schusterman, they'll help you find the right person, just like we have to help you find the right doctor if we're not comfortable doing a procedure. It's exactly the same thing.
I'm going to read one of the anonymous questions. Someone writes, we have two beautiful children through IVF. They're 25 years old, and for the same 25 years, we have some 6 embryos. Are the embryos safe to bring to life? And what is the halakha of taking the life of the embryos if we decide we don't want to donate and are not able to have them? So I guess the first part of the question is, are the embryos safe to bring to life? We
not me.
Look to the doctors.
We believe they're safe. I actually have the chutzpah to brag of having the oldest embryos come to life. They were 13-year-old embryos. I was on Channel 9 with the baby. So we believe that it's safe.
It's embryos.
They had a 13-year-old sister that they adopted. So we believe it's safe. And of course, it's really a Rabbi Schusterman question, but ultimately it is permissible for couples to discard embryos, but again, that's usually with the rabbi's input.
Well, here, Rabbi Schusterman.
We would usually say, go have the baby.
The rabbis I've spoken to about this issue do permit it. To destroy them.
They do permit discarding of embryos.
Yes. I can't say everybody in the world says that, but those are the rabbis that I spoke to.
Okay. Yes?
Thank you so much for the amazing workshop. My question was, is there a protocol, halakhically, of after how long a couple has been married, is a good time to check it out? Is it possible to have the man be checked first, or is it that the woman has to be checked first? And what's the procedure? And is there like a phone number? Do you have a phone number or email that people can contact you with these questions? Because as I saw you 2 days ago, there are a lot of rabbis that do misguide people. And I work as a therapist myself. My husband and I went through a hard time getting pregnant. And a lot of it had to do with people like just telling me to stall in harder, do this harder, say this to healing, do another mishmat kohai, do shira shiri. I mean, you name it, they said it, and they didn't understand that their words would just cause pain for me, not closeness, so they would compare me to Rachel, they would compare me to this matriarch, and it didn't give me a closeness to God, it just put more pressure on me. So I try as much as I can, and actually, the Yankee told me about this, I advertised it on Facebook to the best of my ability, because I actually need to have more workshops and sensitivity about this. So I just wanted to know what the protocol is and what's the
route. Well, the question in a synopsized manner is, what's the protocol where, let's start with rabbis, are referring people to infertility doctors?
In the Jewish tradition, If they're married a month and she's not pregnant, everybody's nervous. Especially the mother-in-law. Any doctor will tell you up to 2 years, correct, there's absolutely nothing to worry about. But after 2 years, again, if they personally are going crazy and they want to start earlier, they're allowed to start earlier. But after 2 years, it's a good idea if the couple doesn't have children, and they want to have children, and they don't have children, they should definitely go to infertility specialists. Now, the doctor will be the one first to test the woman or the man. Halachically, it's better to start with the testing of the woman rather than the man, because we said the man is a complication. How to get the sperm? Not that it's not possible, it's possible, but there are complications. And then halachically, so if they test the woman first, it's easier. And then they can find out it could be a very tiny problem. It could be a problem which is very, very minute. And the doctors take care of it. But we started off by saying what Rabbi Morty said. The previous Rabbi said, you need to have Mesiris Nefesh to have children. Which means everything has to be done to have children. No matter how long you start, how long you work on it, it needs to be worked on as long as biologically possible it is to have children.
So do you also have an email or a phone number or some, or is there like a...
I'm listed in the phone book.
Yeah, okay.
So that's the rabbinical perspective, and I'll give you a little bit of the medical perspective. The first of all, as the whole world is standing on its head and upside down, the Jewish world, unfortunately, is not unaffected by this. So once upon a time, we could say what Rabbi Schusterman just said was totally true, because the average patient walking in the door that was from an infernal was 24 years old. So she had been 22 years, right? So I would agree with that. But, you know, it's out there. The divorces are there. The same Mishagas that affects the non-Jewish world is unfortunately affecting our world. We have the so-called older infertility patient. We have the from woman. We have the Orthodox woman who's converted to Judaism and is now 38 and married to an Orthodox man. We have all of that. So you have to, as the rabbi would agree, individualize that answer. So certainly women are starting to push the time envelope that a more timely intervention is potentially advisable. And also I'd remind you that evaluation doesn't mean treatment, right?
Right.
So even at 6 months, if the mother-in-law is making you crazy, it may be appropriate to do some of the simple tests. Of course, I would argue that the semen analysis is part of that because it's non-invasive, and 50% of the infertility is due to the man. So it would be a shame to put the women through more extensive treatments or testing would not make sure the man is you know, participating appropriately, so to speak. So a shorter period of time for evaluation may be appropriate in certain situations. Like
if they're older.
If they're older, yeah, or if there's such a high anxiety, then at least some basic testing after even 6 months may be appropriate, just to give them the reassurance that everything's okay. Because the average, you know, women in their early 20s tend to be pregnant in 6 months, although we say a year. So I would say medically, like the rabbis, I would give a more individual answer to that, and certainly with our tendency to see older parenting, even in the religious world, then I would say sooner is better. What blew my mind is when I spend a lot of time with these Pua people is that in New York, egg freezing in the Orthodox world is a booming business. We see hardly any of it here. But in New York, apparently, it's a booming business. Single women in their late 30s, it's a shame, Orthodox single women over 35 freezing the race as they can't find a shit off. And so who would have ever thought that would be something we...
I was going to mention that it is going on now.
Yeah. By the way, we're half the price in New York, in case you're interested.
Okay. I'm going to read a question first, okay? If the egg donor is anonymous, how can the baby marry with the possibility that maybe the baby could marry a sibling?
It's both of
you can go first.
Well, that's a great question, that came up when donor sperm was first being discussed. It's a great question. That's one of the reasons why the rabbis recommended non-Jewish donors, because the feeling was, particularly in the observant world, the likelihood of your child accidentally marrying the progeny of your non-Jewish sperm or egg donor is pretty remote. So part of the reason we decided in the early days of egg donation that the egg donor as well should be non-Jewish was that exact question. But now that they've sort of messed it up with, in some circles, encouraging Jewish egg donors, that becomes a more relevant question. And it's a tricky one, which then I can now hand over to Rabbi Shuster.
You have a similar question, by the way, with adoption. When people adopt a baby, there's a whole question in halacha. Is it better to adopt a Jewish baby or a non-Jewish baby and convert them according to halacha? Now, obviously, we're talking about a couple who is religious, because then a religious court, rabbinic court, will not hesitate to convert the kid because they know the kid will be religious. But is it better to adopt a non-Jewish kid or is it better to adopt a Jewish kid? And one of the reasons why many codifiers write it's better to adopt a non-Jewish child, because there is a risk if you adopt a Jewish child and the adoption is closed, a closed adoption, so you don't know who the parents are, there is a slight 1 in 14 million chance, 15 million, that you might end up marrying a sibling, because that person that had a baby might have given up two babies for adoption. But if you adopt a non-Jewish child and convert the child according to Jewish law, so then for sure the child is not related to anybody. So then there wouldn't be an issue with lineage, marriage, that there's remote possibility that a kid will be marrying a sibling. And the same thing is with the egg donors. That's why some people say, but then you go into the other issue, if the egg donor is not Jewish, is the kid Jewish, is not Jewish, who's the, but that's a separate issue by itself. But that's why the pros and cons each way.
Yeah? I was going to ask the question, or maybe it's so obvious that you didn't address it, but what is the standard? We live in the day of single parent children, same sex couples having children through all different types of methodologies and so on. What is the standard for determining the religion of the baby, whether the baby is Jewish or not Jewish?
Well, the question ultimately is the general question, because even, you know, you spoke before, if there was an anonymous donor. So in this case, you're saying it's deliberately an anonymous donor because it's not necessarily a couple of a husband and wife who want to have a child and they brought in a donor. It's just a single woman or whatever else that decided they want to have a child and they brought in an anonymous donor. Well, if it's a woman, what's the religion of the child?
Who's a religion?
In other words, if the donor is a woman, if the donor is a man, then the bottom line is that if the mother is Jewish, the child is still Jewish. Is that correct?
Very possible. In these cases of anonymous donors, many rabbis say they should go through a doubtful conversion to play it safe to make sure the kid's 100% Jewish.
Even if the father is?
No, if the mother is Jewish, in other words, if the donor is Jewish and the mother carrying the baby is Jewish, then the kid's Jewish.
Okay, but if the
carrying the baby?
If let's say the donor is Jewish and the mother carrying the baby is Jewish, then there's no question that the child is Jewish, according to all opinions. The only question is, who's the mother? But that's a separate issue. Is the donor the mother or the one that carries it the mother?
What's the answer?
As everything else, there are different opinions in Jewish law.
And when that situation arises, come speak to Rabbi Shuster.
No, don't speak to me, because you're not going to get
Well, actually, I thought the question you were asking was, what about single parenting? Because that's blowing the rabbis' minds altogether, right? Because there are, again, sadly, a small but growing body of from women who can't make a shidduch, decide to heck with it, I'm having a baby. And that's got to be bending the rabbis' minds altogether. So that, I mean, I thought you were actually going there.
Or same sex.
Well, same sex becomes okay. Well, the same sex thing is a bigger problem than the parenting. I go to Australia occasionally to these conferences. And I was approached by two men, one Jewish, one not. They wanted to do egg donor and a surrogate, the whole thing. And they're asking me, will the baby be Jewish? I'm sitting there thinking, you know, like, there's a much bigger issue than that. But I gave him the answer that Rabbi Shuster gave. If you don't have a Jewish donor, and Jewish surrogates are about as rare as hen's teeth. So if you don't have a Jewish, so by definition, there's no Jewish surrogate. And so I just advised them to convert the baby at birth if that was important to you. But I mean, you get these mind-blowing questions now because, you know, this is not where Rabbi thought we would be. be talking about.
Somebody had a question here. Is it true that in Jewish religion, the fetus is not deemed viable until it graduates from medical school?
100%.
Yes?
I have a question. How come a sister cannot be a surrogate for a sister?
The question is, why can't a sister be a surrogate for a sister?
So if
I assume you're asking halakhically, not medically.
Yeah, halakhically. Like if somebody's sister, it's not, look, one of the a sister cannot carry a baby, why can't they implant her sister to carry the baby?
If surrogate is allowed, then there probably wouldn't be any difference if it's a sister, okay?
It's not allowed,
though. It's not a surrogacy.
Is it allowed? Because, as mentioned before, there's the various halachic issues. I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying there are different opinions.
Sister in a church.
Huh?
Sister in a church.
Yeah. Well, the sister, I think, would have to be single, too.
Yeah, but then you go into the whole issue. Is it considered a mamzer? Because if you inseminate a married woman with somebody else's sperm, is that considered a mamzer or not? And that's another issue by itself. As a rule, most codifiers say it's not, because it has to be through actual intercourse to create the legitimacy of a mamzer. But otherwise, if it's not done that way, it's not a mamzer.
But you wouldn't agree that if, I mean, the surrogacy is the great frontier, it's a bigger question, not the sister, but any Jewish surrogate would have to be single, wouldn't she? Then?
That's the question in halacha, not necessarily.
So I think it's clear the answer again is ask the rabbi, ask the time.
Most rabbis today are uncomfortable with surrogacy. They're allowing it at a limited level in Israel now. It's killed my business. But we don't get patients from Israel except gay men.
There's a big controversy in Israel about surrogate, if it's allowed, if it's not allowed, and who is the halachic mother of the child, the donor of the egg or the one that actually carries the baby. And they have proofs in Talmud both ways. So,
yes?
You mentioned earlier about genetic distortion by Pesachs, and how they're either exclusive or predominant to the Ashkenazi Jewish community. Do we know why that is?
First of all, it's not predominant, it's just more common. Uh-huh. The belief is that because of our both forced and somewhat voluntary seclusion in ghetto life and away from the non-Jewish world for centuries, you know, it's well known that the more intramarriage within a population, the more a recessive gene becomes enhanced in that population. That's the general belief. There can be potential biological causes, so there's a belief, for instance, with sickle cell, that the carriers of sickle cell were more immune to malaria. So there was a survival benefit to being a carrier of the sickle cell, but of course then the children were dying, you know, from the sickle cell disease. So in the case of Tay-Sachs and the other panel, it's mostly, I believe, the sequestration of the Jewish population for centuries from the non-Jewish world. There was less of that sequestration in the Sephardic world, less of it. And so there are far less genes common to the Sephardic world than in the Ashkenazi world. That's kind of a proof of the principle.
So you think this is about intramarriage?
You should come into the field.
Intramarriage means between cousins, first cousins?
Yes, so in other words, more cousin marriages, which are halakhically allowed, would increase the rate of recessive genes. And then on top of that, we were forced to stay away from the Gentile world, both voluntarily and involuntarily in a way, right? I mean, because even if we were not in ghettos, we would tend to not marry, but there would have been some intermarriage even then, and that's probably why there is a higher rate of Tay-Sachs and a few other recessive traits in the Jewish people.
I was going to also add that to date, up until recently, it was all about the Ashkenazi Jews and the Ashkenazi Jewish panel. But now we've found the same seclusion, what's called the founder effect, also common in the Persian Jewish population. And the Persian, it's what we call now, we have the non-Ashkenazi Jewish panel. So basically Jews that are non-Ashkenazi that also have isolated themselves, where you see where you see consanguinity, which is the technical term for family members marrying family members, like first cousins, for example. And so currently, for couples in the non-Ashkenazi, or in our community, and many of my patients, the Persian Jewish patients, we have a panel that we run on them as well to determine whether both parents are carriers of any of these diseases and whether the fetus would be affected or not.
Yeah.
Recent developments in genetic technologies has enabled us to have quote-unquote three-parent embryos, where you have an egg donor, a sperm donor, and a mitochondrial donor. I was wondering if that's been discussed at all yet within the Jewish community, and if that it violates the prohibition against genetic crossbreeding.
Well, just so people understand, first, why three parents? So the reason there are three parents is the mitochondria is a part of a cell. It's found within the cell, and the mitochondria carries its own genetic material. And there are mitochondrial diseases that are specifically associated with the DNA that's within the mitochondria. And therefore, in couples where the woman, for example, carries a mitochondrial disease, comes the third parent, which really only donates the mitochondria, the mitochondrial DNA, and therefore relieves that that disease risk. Now, whether it's allowed or not, that's the gentleman to my right.
I've heard that it's being discussed in halacha. I haven't heard any conclusive things about it. I can't imagine it being too much different than two parents. The Talmud says, by the way, that every person has three parents: father, mother, and God. So this is another.
Any other questions? Yes.
You talked about during the fertilization stage, after the egg is fertilized, that you remove a small amount of the fertilized egg for genetic testing. Is there a guarantee that that doesn't cause any harm to the future?
I'm just going to repeat it because she said it quietly. You talked that during the right after fertilization, they remove a little bit of the fertilized egg to test it, and her concern was could that cause damage to the fetus?
That's a good question. First of all, the biopsy is done 5 days later, not right after, so that is 5 days. The word guarantee is not in our vocabulary, so there's no guarantee. But if you remember the picture I showed you, there's that outer ring of cells. It's the trophoblast. It's the placental layer. So we believe now it does not damage the embryo. We're taking it the opposite end of the blastocyst from where the embryo is developing. There's really no good evidence that it hurts the embryos. Even, you know, I used to have the picture. I took it out. We did it at the 8-cell stage not long ago. And it seemed to be safe then, but, you know, that certainly would be more concerning. You're taking up 15%. The embryo is very intrusive. But now with blastocyst biopsy, I'd say probably safe. You know, you can never say guarantee. We're not really near the embryo.
Yes?
If each of you had a misconception that you want to turn the button, that would want to, you
dispel.
Know, you could, yeah, it's a spell, thank you. What would it be? Something you feel like people come to your
head
wrong
or
statement?
That's a great question. I would say I'd like to dispel the myth that when it comes to what we do, that the rabbis are stodgy old misogynists that, you know, don't care about women. It's not true at all. They're very sensitive to it. A lot of the leniencies they give are for the women. And they look. We're talking about a certain group of rabbis. I mean, they're not a small group, but in our field, they're looking for ways to help people do this, not block them. Because at the end of the day, having a child is an extremely sacred act, and you want to have that baby in a way that it's sacred. But once you get through that premise, it can be done. So there's very little that we're blocked from doing by the rabbis. We just might have to dance to the left or the right a little bit, and we're happy to do it. I love doing it because I always want to be able to accommodate everybody as best as we can, especially our Jewish patients. On the medical side, I just would say that IVF is safer than feared. If it's done cautiously, you can have a good outcome by limiting complications like hyperstimulation syndrome, something that happens with drugs, and most importantly, multiple pregnancies.
For me, I would say that not every woman, how do I phrase this? Just because you're 35 and older, you're not a high-risk pregnancy, and does not automatically mean that you need an amniocentesis to evaluate the baby. There's really no difference whether you're 34 or 35. The way that 35 came into play is that back in the day when ultrasound looked like you were adjusting your antenna on your TV, and really people could not evaluate the fetus with any clarity or any detail. At that point, they really relied on amniocentesis. As a woman ages, her risk of Down syndrome, which is one of the most common genetic abnormalities, increases. When she hits 35, that risk is approximately 1 in 250, 1 in 300. And back in the day, when you did an amniocentesis, the risk of miscarriage from an amniocentesis was about 1 in 250 or 1 in 300. So that's where the 35 came in. A woman that was 35 came into the office. They told her, congratulations, you're 35. Your risks are even. You're getting an amniocentesis. That's no longer the case. Today, we're able to, as I've noted, make the assessments on the perform the assessments on these fetuses non-invasively. We try to, as much as we can, do more non-invasive testing, and really being 35 or 36 or 37, the most important aspect is really how healthy the woman is, because that's what really increases her risk with a pregnancy.
Good answer.
Now the rabbinic myth. There is a myth out there that rabbis are narrow-minded, old school, everything is forbidden. But, you know, the Talmud says, Korach Datera Odif. It takes a stronger power to permit something, according to Torah, than it is to forbid it. It's very easy to say no, 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 no. And if you're not religious, it's very easy to say yes, yes, yes. But to be religious and to say yes versus no, it takes a much stronger power. Rabbis, contrary to many, many people's beliefs, are there to help people. Rabbis' lives are not to make people's lives miserable and difficult and forbid everything. As long as it's within the confines of halacha and there are competent rabbis to deal with halacha, then rabbis will bend backwards to permit it as long as it's correct according to Torah law. And that's it. And everything in of... Because, as Rabbi Morty mentioned before at the beginning, because Torah is a God-given wisdom, which is above time and place, any medical or technological issue that exists in the world, you will find in the Torah. Whether it's heart transplants, whether any of these things, to guidelines and basic concepts of the Torah, you can address all of these issues. Like when they start living on the moon, besides the fact that when they get there, Chabad will be there to greet them, how to keep Shabbos on the moon, they will find there are answers to all these questions. Or if you're an astronaut flying around the world, who knows how fast, you know, when do you daven Shachris, when do you put on tefillin, when do you daven Mincha, when do you daven Maariv, when do you go to sleep, or when Shabbos. All of these things are found in Torah. We need to apply it. But the role of a rabbi is to help people and not to make their life miserable. It's a myth out there.
First of all, I want to take this opportunity to thank our very esteemed panelists for a truly an amazing, informative evening. I think all three of you made it very, very clear there is no such thing as any topics being off limits. And that's very important. I want to end with a very short story. We'll go back a little bit more than a half a century to this very same field. A young couple got married, and after 6 months, they didn't have a child. Of course, they were in a panic, but actually, the woman became pregnant, and unfortunately, after some time, she had a miscarriage. It happened the second time, and it happened the third time. There was no Dr. Feynman to go to, there was no Dr. Monsanto to go to, and the doctors that they went to told her, unfortunately, you're unable to carry a pregnancy to term, and there's nothing we can do for you, you'll never have children, and they were devastated. They ultimately moved from down south to the New York area, and there in New York, they didn't have children. They were convinced to write a letter to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and they wrote a letter to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe gave them a bracha, and the blessing was, you should check your tefillin, you should check your mezuzahs, and God will bless you with children. In fact, they did so. He found out that the tefillin that he'd been putting on since his bar mitzvah were never kosher, and he put them on every day. They were not kosher. The mezuzahs were all, thank God, very good, except for one mezuzah wasn't good, one wasn't placed right. They replaced the bad mezuzah, fixed the other mezuzah, and got a new pair of children. Shortly afterwards, she became pregnant, and a difficult pregnancy, and whatever technology they had in those days, they did, and bed rest and all the other stuff. And miracle of miracles, after 9 months, she gave birth to a healthy baby girl, and it was a great celebration. Shortly afterwards, a few months later, she became pregnant again. They moved back down south to North Carolina again, and there in North Carolina, she went to see an OBGYN, and the only records, medical records they had there were the state records from North Carolina. They had nothing from New York, and he saw the situation, he saw her medical condition, and said, what's wrong with you, lady? You can't have children. Why are you becoming pregnant again? And she said, excuse me, and she had her husband come in from the waiting room. He came in holding the baby. She said, this is mine. The doctor said, how? So she told him medically how she wrote to the Rebbe, and how the Rebbe said, and the children, and the mezuzahs, and Baruch Hashem. The doctor looked and said, it's a miracle. They gave birth to another baby girl, and then a third baby girl, and then the children were old enough to need a proper Jewish education. There was nothing then in North Carolina. They moved back up north to New Jersey, and she was pregnant with a fourth child, and she gave birth to a fourth child, and this time it was a baby boy, and that baby was me. I tell you that story to put this all together. This is about miracles. Whether it's miracles from the Rebbe's blessings and from our tefillin and our mezuzahs, whether it's the miracles of modern science, it's not an expression, it's the miracles of modern science. And that explains why all of this has to do with not a doctor, but the doctors and the rabbis together, because it's all about God, and it's all about the blessings that come from God. And may we all be blessed with children and grandchildren and many, many generations of greatness and of Jewish pride, and may we merit the coming of Mashiach. Thank you all for coming. There will be Myron in 5 minutes in the library for those that missed it. Thank you again. Good night.